Chase Taylor from Pinecone Macro Research. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom.
Chase, I wanted to have you on today because you recently wrote a really interesting piece about asking the right questions about the war rather than necessarily just searching for answers at this point. I think that's a really interesting way to frame today's conversation. But before we do that, can you give us a little bit about your background in the intelligence side of things and how that obviously really helps you kind of navigate these times? I think, you were mentioning to me before we hit record here today, the delta between what we're being told versus what is actually going on or some of the reports that you're getting. So how challenging of an environment is this to actually try to understand rather than, just be able to rely on a piece of news or any one of the news platforms that we have normal access to?
Yeah. So for my background, 17 years in the Air Force, and most of that was around the intelligence community, most of it in geospatial intelligence. So think of imagery and then combining it, imagery with all the other forms of intelligence to create a more clear picture. Just going through that, you have to learn a lot about war in general. You have to learn a lot about equipment in general. So like the capabilities of what other people have, what it can do, like all understanding all these things. And then I'm just a nerd about history and war and geopolitics and everything. So I'm always learning about these things just on my own to begin with. But yeah, whenever the war started, it was on a Saturday, and then I wrote my piece on a Sunday. I was all teed up to write a private credit piece, and then the war started. I'm like, all right, I have to like tackle this. But as the war began, it was kind of clear to me, like, all right, what we know versus what we don't know, there's so much more that we don't know. So what I decided to do was make a list of questions to kind of like track as we move forward instead of make a bunch of bold calls, other than a couple that I did make, in that first piece, which were mostly just around some Iranian capabilities that to me were they obviously had that I thought the average investor, maybe even the average person at the Pentagon, were kind of sleeping on, or the average decision maker in the White House, maybe I should say, instead of the Pentagon. That may be unfair to the folks at the Pentagon, but, and then I wrote another piece, whatever, 2 or 3 weeks ago or something, kind of answering most of those questions. You know, a couple of them you still didn't have a clear answer, but a lot of them, like, you had answers starting to emerge, and then the answers to those questions really help lead you in the right direction of kind of where we're at with the market. And obviously with the market, a big part of this is just what is it pricing in and what is it not? So like, you know, if you're really worried about the war and all the impacts of it, but oil was 150 today and the S&P was in a 40% drawdown, then you're like, sure, the war's a big problem, but the market's more than pricing it or at least pricing it. Yeah. But I think when you look, you know, Strait of Hormuz has been closed for almost 5 weeks and, you know, the S&P is down like 7%, oil's, you know, it's a little above 100, but even there, you look out at like, if you look at like kind of 20 months, 19 months away, oil's like $68. Like, so is any of this really being priced to last? Not at all. So, like there's been a massive delta between the reality on the ground and the war, and then the public narrative and kind of what people are thinking. A perfect example of this is, I think it was either the first or second Monday after the war, and I was in jury duty following it that day. There's been multiple of these where like the market bought something and it was like, no, what are you doing? The first one was, well, don't worry about the Strait because we're gonna do the insurance and we'll do some escorts and it's gonna be fine. And this is an area like this is like I immediately know like no, like you can't do the escorts because the asymmetry that Iran has from a, you know, pure equipment standpoint, not going to work. Like you don't get to do the X. So he's like immediately the market just rips, oil goes down. And because you just know a little bit about the way these drones work and stuff, you're like, yep, that won't work. So able to like lean against that. And there's been, I don't know, a half dozen different times where a new headline pops, market rips, oil goes down. And you look at the headline, you look into the information. And if you know a little bit about this stuff, even you're like, yep, nope, that's not how that's going to go down. So It's funny because everyone knows you don't trade geopolitics, you don't trade war because you don't know anything, nobody knows anything. But the reality is, like, some of the stuff isn't that difficult. Like knowing that escorts won't work was not, it's not because I have, you know, a PhD in war or something like it. It just wasn't that hard.
Right. Have you noticed the, I think somebody was pointing out the pattern of Trump coming out on a Monday saying something, markets rip. By Wednesday, we kind of have an idea of what's actually happening. And then by Friday, everything seems to kind of be priced in and we kind of get a bit more of a realistic view.
Yeah, I think it, you know, as long as the war's going on, people hedge into the weekend, so you get some negative pressures going in, and a lot of people pull them off come Monday. Plus, yeah, you also get, you know, well-timed right before the open or right after the close news flow that's clearly been very deliberate about how great negotiations are going. And this isn't just a Iran war phenomenon. Like, if you go back to trade negotiations, anytime the market got squirrely, like you got a quick update about how great it was going, progress was being made, and like, and as I think we all know, like the administration loves to hammer home the 2 week, like in 2 weeks this is gonna be great, like kind of thing. So, you know, this has been the 4 to 6 weeks, which we only have a week and a half left on, but yeah, it's obviously being done by design to kind of move the market to a degree, and it's, but you know, instead of, a lot of people get mad about that. I'm like, what do you, if he wants to move the market the way it should not go and let me get in and re-enter, you know, some of these trades, like I'm all for it. And the same with oil, like, you know, these December 27 oil got smoked today, which really hurts me because I have a good bit of it. But I'm looking at it, and I'm like, I think oil's worth 67 at the end of 2027, even if the war never started, much less if it ends tomorrow. So like, if you want to give me that opportunity, if these oil hedgers want to give me that opportunity, I'll take it.
Right. Yeah, it's such an interesting time and it there's so much to try and pay attention to, but I wanted to pull a couple of those questions because I think it helps kind of illustrate where we are. So what happens if the US and Israel want a ceasefire, but Iran does not?
Yeah, that was a question that I came up with one day into the war, and I don't think that was on too many people's bingo card early on. Now I think everyone realizes, like, oh yeah, that's right, Iran gets a vote here, and they may not want the same thing everybody else wants. And you know, where we're at right now, we have maximalist demands, they have maximalist demands, at least publicly. Who knows what's actually being discussed, you know, behind the scenes, if anything. But somewhere in there, like in that range between the two asks, is where we end up, because this probably can't go on for too much longer, just economically speaking, politically speaking. The problem is, in my opinion, Iran has not only the operational leverage, they have the economic leverage. You know, they have time on their side in a way that the US doesn't. Like, so they have a lot of leverage and they have escalation dominance, in my view, which is very, very important. Like, I think people probably remember back to the, if you have 48 hours to open the strait or we'll blow up all your power plants. And Iran's like, that's cool, we'll blow up the whole region's power plants and desalination plants. And then it was like, okay, well, just kidding. We're having talks and they're going great, so we're not going to do that. And then we extended that timeline again. That What that made clear is, like, they have escalation dominance. They're able to say, like, oh, you'll do what? We'll do this. And we, because what they would do back is credible now that they have hit many, many very important targets in this war. Like, you have to take that seriously and go, like, oh, they probably would do that. Because, you know, the last time they're like, hey, look, if you hit our energy infrastructure, we're going to hit yours. We hit their energy infrastructure, and then they took off almost 20% of Qatar's LNG export capacity for 3 to 5 years. Like, that is serious stuff. Like, you can't ignore that. So I'm sure whenever we said we'll blow up all your stuff, and they said we'll just take out the region's infrastructure, no doubt the entire Gulf region called the president and were like, hey, like, you can't do this, man. Like, we need lights and water, as it turns out, so please don't. So knowing that they have time dominance, escalation dominance, you know, leverage, because they still haven't closed the Red Sea, and they still could, like, they still haven't hit power plants and desalination plants and many refineries, many production assets, like, but they still can do all of that. Like, you have to respect their ability to escalate. So there's a lot stacked against the US, which means, we are probably going to have to take some unfavorable terms. And I know a lot of people got upset about, the president saying, like, well, maybe we'll just leave and leave Hormuz up to everybody else. That sounds awful. Like, the US has been built on naval dominance and keeping waterways open and free for, 75 years. But I think the reality on the ground and the reality of technology and asymmetry is like dictates that that's probably over, and you could either pay the insane cost of trying to reopen that by force, or you could just understand that you have to take that strategic loss. But that's all easy to say, like, oh yeah, just take this giant strategic loss and let's move on with our lives. Like, but when you're the policymaker that has to actually stare down that barrel, like, that's a very tough decision to make. It's a very tough action to follow through with. But my current view, and it could change, but my current view is because Iran has so much leverage currently, like, we will probably have to take a very unfortunate strategic loss to get out of this conflict.
Chase, do you feel like much of this was I hate to phrase it so bluntly, but like a giant miscalculation on both the US and Israel's behalf?
Yes, big time. And I wrote in that same piece with the questions that I thought, this was a bad idea, because and the main reason was because I said, I think Iran's capabilities are very underrated. And I felt like a crazy person for saying that. Nobody agreed with me, really. But I sold them short. Like, I knew their missiles were good. I knew they could hit targets in a very real way. They demonstrated that. It didn't get reported widely in the West, but they demonstrated the capability to do this. Like, they put a giant hole in a road really close to like a headquarters of a very important military like thing in Israel. They did the same to like some US nearby US assets to be like, look, we can hit stuff. Like, please, like, understand that. So it was kind of clear, like, hey, if this thing is real and it goes existential for them, like, they're gonna stop bombing the sand and start bombing real stuff. But, it's not like I was sitting there going, like, hey, we're probably gonna have multiple really important bases of ours in the region get dramatically damaged. We're probably gonna lose some fighters, some fighter jets, a bunch of drones, an E-3 Sentry, like an AWACS, like, with one damage, one completely destroyed, multiple refueling aircraft destroyed, an F-35 hit in the air. I wouldn't have guessed any of that. Multiple radars for anti-aircraft, anti-missile defense stuff. Like, I didn't think they could do all this. So, like, here I was, like, really worried about it and feeling like a crazy person for being worried about it. And they've surprised me. But I will say, like, yeah, total miscalculation from a decision maker standpoint, both Israel and the US. But I think it's important to note, like, the intelligence community's assessments on this, I think we're spot on. Like, if you go back and look, they basically said, like, hey, this probably won't go great. Like, this they probably won't end in regime change, like, which is probably the most important point. But, like, you're probably not going to be able to end their missile program just by, like, doing this stuff. And then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane, like, it immediately got leaked that he pushed back and said this is a bad idea, we shouldn't do it. Obviously, he's prosecuting the wars and helping direct everything, like, it's his job. But, like, he made it clear through those early leaks, like, yeah, I try to tell him this is a bad idea. So to me, like, when you have the highest ranking military officer and the intelligence community giving you frank assessment to be like, yeah, this probably won't work, I wouldn't do it, like, the miscalculation, it really just floats to the highest levels. And it is obvious that the US was listening heavily to the Israelis on this, and it seems like some frustration between the two because they listened so heavily to the Iranian side, their view of it. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't just, and it's not just a tactical miscalculation. Like, this is going to have massive strategic implications. Like, tactically, we've done great. We've blown up all kinds of stuff. That's, but tactics and strategy are two different things. And at the end of the day, we're probably going to leave with having lost free access to the Persian Gulf that isn't controlled in some way by Iran. They will keep their missile program. They may, in some way, keep some of their nuclear program. They may have sanctions removed. Like they're going to emerge from this in a much better position than they went in. And by reports, at least, it seemed like the. Well, first of all, we've already had a nuclear deal in place with them that we took off. But even then, it sounded like they were willing to give pretty substantially on the nuclear stuff heading into this, like in the negotiations in Oman. And that's not just the Omani people. That's like a UK diplomat said that. So to go from that to this is there's no two ways about it. It's a strategic loss, and given the power they've shown with the drones and missiles, my assumption is now they're looking for security guarantees to exit the war, which makes sense. But I think their missiles are and their drones basically are a security guarantee. Like, I don't think anyone's really going to want to do this again. Not to mention the closing strait part. Like, if you know that someone can hit you with a bunch of missiles and drones and close the strait, are you really going to mess with them? Like, probably not. So even though they're going to emerge from this in a financial crisis and with a lot of messed up infrastructure, they also will emerge from this as a regional hegemon and an emergent middle power. Like, they're going to be a lot more powerful. Like, now, what they do with that, they might screw it up. They might really make something of it. They may have a civil war within 6 months because they have two factions competing for control of it all. Like, who knows? But on the day after, like, they emerge from this in a better position than they went in. And for us, globally, especially, like, it's the opposite, unfortunately.
It seems like a very asymmetric calculation when Iran is basically winning to them is surviving, and the US had so many things, so many, a massive list of demands of what it wants. And I think it's almost impossible to be able to back away from that without, losing face. And I think that, say what you will about Donald Trump, but it does seem like that is something that is very important to him, which is not losing face.
And I think the guy he's talked about wanting to be on Mount Rushmore, and losing a war to Iran's not a good way to get on there. So, like, I'm sure this is deeply disturbing to him to have to take this loss. Now, he'll obviously frame it as a giant win and sell it that way. But how history treats this, I think will be clear. But I will say, though, like, cl it's clear to me, at least, that saving face isn't worth, losing 100,000 young people's lives, and $1 trillion or whatever it would take to not lose face. So in that way, I give him credit, because I think he is willing to make that right call, hopefully. Like, it's still to be determined, but I think his fluidity and flexibility has been one of his biggest assets. I think he already wants out completely. Like, him, they have taken, like, the big goals from, like, all this stuff they wanted to do, regime change and, no more this and that, like, all the way down to Rubio yesterday. I was like, well, we want to get rid of the Air Force, the Navy, both of which were completely irrelevant anyway, and reduce their missile capacity or whatever. Like, those are very small goals, which means they have, conditioned everybody to be like, hey, we already won. It's good. We can get out. Same with, hey, we'll just leave Hormuz to you guys. Everybody else can figure it out. Like, that means they can move out at any moment. But on the flip side, we have an immense amount of personnel and equipment already in the region or heading to the region. It looks like more is yet to come, very possibly on the ground. So in that way, you have mixed messages. Who knows if all of the assets we have put in place and continue to put in place are there for some sort of negotiation leverage, or if they're there to try to change the reality on the ground. We'll probably all figure that out this weekend.
Well, that's what I was wondering as well, Chase, is like, what are the actual, let's say, options on the table here? Like, does Trump realize what a miscalculation this was and he leaves admitting defeat, I mean, victory, and keeps going? Or does he keep making, let's say, bad decision after bad and tries a ground invasion?
It's a great question. I struggle with it some. Like, and on some level, like, the public facing rhetoric It's so bad, so wrong that like there's a big part of it has to be like, all right, well, hold on. At least on the inside, they know this is not right, right? Like, you know what I mean? But there's a part of me that because the sycophancy within the White House and some of the key personnel that are, let's be honest, like basically influencers and not to mention very loyal influencers, not strategic thinkers. Like it worries me, like maybe there is that slim chance that no, like they actually think the things that they're saying publicly, or at least more so than you would think or hope. I still think no, like they know the reality. They just have to say stuff publicly for domestic consumption, make sure the base isn't freaking out too much, whatever the case is. But there's a little part of me that does worry. And I've read where they're giving them like a 2 minute, like, you know, highlight reels of the strikes of the day prior every day and stuff like, so if you just feed in them that and the good news and stuff, and this has happened in plenty of wars and plenty of countries all throughout history where you feed the leader like, oh yeah, it's going great, man. Like look at Vietnam, right? They kept giving the statistical highlights of, yeah, we, man, you know, we're taking out X percent more of their targets than they are of ours. Like we're totally winning. And that seemed to kind of keep that war going for years past when it should have ended. So it's not impossible that he's just getting all the good news and how great it's going, and keeping maximalist demands on Iran, thinking like, why wouldn't they give up? We obliterated them. Like they're totally done. But I think the reality is he probably understands exactly where he's at, struggling to find a way out that saves at least some face, trying to find a way to get there. As far as the options go, I struggle with this too. Maybe I have a blind spot here. I've really tried to find some positive outcomes to like brainstorm that I haven't thought of yet. But everything I've heard publicly floated, or that I have been able to think of, is just not. It's not. It doesn't change anything. Like, you know, as far as reopening the strait, like not going to happen with a few boots on the ground. Like, and to be clear for people, why I knew like the you know. Using a few ships to like take some tankers through and all that stuff that wasn't going to work. Like Iran can hit shipping with obviously the aerial drones that they have. They can do it with missiles, and they have multiple different kinds of missiles they can use for that. But they also have these suicide boats, remote control boats. They have gun boats. They have submerged, like underwater drones, which are very good. It's basically like a freaking UAV torpedo, you know, like it. And then they have surface level drones. So you could have a drone underwater, on water, above water, missiles, like all coming at a ship going 12 knots at a time that's as big as five football fields or whatever. Like, yeah, like come on. Like, that's all physics and it's pretty simple stuff, right? And yeah, like our stuff is really good at shooting down the missiles coming or whatever. Like, we could knock most of those down, but can you knock down all the underwater drones too, and the ones on the surface, and they still have torpedoes too. Like, can you stop it all? It's a question, and the answer is obviously no. That's why we haven't even tried. So, can you reopen the strait by taking the land around it? No, because everything I just mentioned, it works in the whole Gulf. It's not like none of this stuff works once you get 20 kilometers north of the strait. Like, and all you got to do is hit one ship a month, and no one's going to want to go in there. So taking some territory near the strait isn't going to do it. Taking Karg Island, I've seen, you know, U.S. senators talking like that'll bankrupt them, and they'll be begging for a deal in no times. First of all, you think money like is a part of this right now? You're insane. Like they would happily be bankrupt and keep this war going for a while. Plus, like they've made a fortune off selling their oil at these new high prices, free of sanctions, I might add. Since the war started, like they're still getting their tankers out, no problem, because they control the strait. And they're making way more money by doing it. So you could take Karg Island, you could hold Karg Island for 3 months. They're not gonna capitulate. Plus, hundreds or thousands of people will die in Karg Island because they're easy targets for artillery, drones, missiles, gunboats, so you name it. I mean, the ability to supply, resupply, and shelter anyone that was on that island or any of these islands would be very minimal, especially from all these, again, asymmetric threats that Iran poses. Especially these days, now that, you know, drones are, the small like FPV drones are very good at anti-personnel these days, so you can't jam them. We're obviously not great at shooting them down, like, so any ground thing that is that I've heard proposed wouldn't work. Now, I do think the it's possible that you could get the uranium out. I just don't think that matters strategically. Like, let's say tomorrow we wake up and like, yep, we got all the 60% or higher or whatever enriched uranium out. We win. But what do you win? Like, the strait's still closed, they still have the missiles, they still have the regime, they still have the economic leverage, they still have time on their side because the strait's closed. Like, it wouldn't really change anything. Plus, you know, they can enrich uranium again in the future. Like, what did you really do? So when I look at all these options that I've heard discussed, I don't see anything that changes the balance of power in a meaningful way. Maybe you drop a bunch of dudes in, like right in the heart of Tehran, you sneak them through, and you go in and decapitate another round of leadership or something. And maybe that magically works. I don't know, but I'm not saying there's a 0% chance you can come up with something that changes the negotiating leverage, but I see it as incredibly low probability and incredibly high risk for sure.
As you're explaining this, Chase, I just have the a picture of kicking a bee's nest, really. Like, I don't know that your point about the uranium is extremely important, right? Okay, great. If you get the physical uranium that they have enriched up to a nuclear reactor capacity or level, that's great. But somehow you would have to still go through and demolish all of their ability to refine anymore, to process anymore, to enrich anymore. And that seems like a far bigger ask and a far bigger job than just getting some of the actual uranium. And again, that seems like a far bigger project and far longer term. But you know, obviously the let's say the biggest piece of leverage here, or the biggest thing that everybody is fighting over is the Strait of Hormuz here. So, how important is it to not only be getting traffic out, but also getting traffic in?
Yeah, I mean, it's everything. And this is where going back to questions is very important. So in scenarios, I think scenarios are lost way too much on traders and investors, I think, using scenario analysis. So, like, because we don't know this leadership in Iran very well, it's hard to game out what they're going to do. So one of the things I'm thinking about a lot is the scenarios around, let's say the war ends tomorrow. We're just like, we're done, we're out, we leave, or we have a negotiated settlement, whatever. But they control the strait. We leave, the war's over. What do they do with the strait becomes the important question, because if it's just ever it's free and open again, but you just have to throw some change in the toll booth to Tehran, like, then that's not the big a deal. Like, everyone would happily do it. Like, you see that the administration has come out the last couple of days and been like, you guys can come open the strait yourselves, come fight it out, it's not even dangerous, come do it. Like, the reality is no one's going to do that. Like, if you're Europe or Asia, you're going to be like, pass, but I'll just throw the $2 million of coins in the toll. Like, that's not that big a deal for us. Like, we'll just do that. So
Considering they
that's
don't
where you would head.
have, considering they don't have the energy otherwise. Right.
Yeah, plus you can't stop it. Like, at least currently, maybe you get to a point where there's some new technological innovation that is incredible at just making the drone threat just die before it can get to you. That's, not impossible. Some like microwave force field or something. I don't know, but for now it doesn't seem like we know how to do that. So, but eventually we'll get there maybe, and then this whole thing can reorient, but that's probably not a 2026 story. So, but I think the scenario thing is like, is it wide open, or are they like not kidding? Like, no, like, if you're not our friend, you don't get to come in here. Like, and punish the Gulf states even after the war's over. Are they really nasty after the war's over? Or as soon as the war's over, do they open up and we're like, hey, look, we've been mean to you guys because we're afraid for our own safety. Now we feel pretty good about our own safety. Like, so it's fine. Let's trade, and we don't have to be friends, but like, we don't have to be enemies anymore. Like, I could see it going either way. Maybe these new hardliners are just jerks and they just want to punish everybody that's ever been mean to them. But also, it's possible that they finally feel secure because they recognize, like, oh, our missiles are actually a bigger deal than everyone realized, and maybe that we realized. And then obviously, they may exit the war with security guarantees, maybe even back by China and stuff like. So if you roll out with control of the strait, with some sanctions relief, and with America being like, we promise we aren't coming back, then they can feel secure in themselves, and then maybe you can pivot to commercial life and trying to rebuild in more positive ways, like trading more, being back in the global economy without the sanctions and everything. I think people have to think seriously about both those tracks. Obviously, there'll probably be some mess in the middle, but like about following the news flow as we get out of it to see which side is leaning, like open and reasonably accommodative to neighbors, or just they're monsters, right? But even if they're monsters, especially with the Strait, like, now your enemy is the whole world. Like, everyone needs this stuff that comes out of the Gulf. So like my assumption is they can't keep the Strait even like 20% clogged, because everyone would be so mad, to include, their friends like China, Russia, the Axis countries. Like, they're not gonna put up with that either. So I don't think it'll work that way. I think they'll collect their toll, and if they felt existentially threatened again, sure, they would close it. But other than that, I wouldn't think so.
Right. One last question on kind of the, let's say the logistics of the war or what the war actually means, Chase. Do you see there being any domestic risks on US soil from Iran?
I think the obvious answer is yes. It's just I don't know how acute or how big or widespread it is. I mean, we've seen a couple of minor incidents already. You've seen a couple throughout Europe. But my assumption is obviously they don't have full control over every proxy and stuff like that. So like it can always get away from them. But I would assume in any way that they have control over, they know how much that would not help them. Not just from a PR standpoint, because if they do want to emerge from this as like, oh, like we're big boys now, like we're not going to be mean, like the last thing they need is some terror attack, far away from the front lines. Like, I think they have a reasonable amount of sympathy in a place like Turkey, right? Where they're hitting mostly, not all, like they have hit some stuff they shouldn't have hit without question, but like mostly hitting like military assets. Or they wait for the US and Israel to hit something and then they hit it back. So we hit their steel plant and they're like, cool, we'll hit aluminum smelters. And like, we put it on the list, they put it on the list, kind of thing. Like, so I think all of that allows them to have a lot of sympathy, especially in the Muslim world. If they go doing terror attacks, in America and stuff, like, then you start winding down like public support in a place like Turkey, where like the average person, I mean, I love Iran, but like they're like kind of like, well, they're kind of defending themselves at the moment. So I would assume in any way they can control, they will keep that from happening. Now, do I think they would launch a military attack, using a drone from offshore or something like there's been some chatter about? I really don't. I don't think that is a I'm not saying it's a 0% chance by any stretch, but I don't think that is a, odds on probability that anyone has to be super concerned about.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you saw, but I saw a list that was released today, that if Iran sees any more assassinations, the IRGC is now threatening American companies. So it was companies
Right.
like Cisco, HP, Intel, Oracle, Microsoft, Apple, Google,
And
Meta, IBM.
all of those companies have assets in the region that they've already reached out and touched some of them, to be clear. Like, Intel has a facility in Israel that's very messed up. Like, some data centers have seen some damage. So yeah, I would not be surprised if at all if they did that, Now, US soil, I don't think so, but U.S. assets in the region, absolutely. I would not expect them to hold back on that stuff, especially like you said, like when they can draw a line and say, if you do this, we're going to hit those. I think it's obvious to me that everyone should take that seriously, because they followed through every time so far.
Yeah, exactly. To see that they mean what they say and can't have the capabilities of doing it, I think makes that line much clearer, right?
Yeah, and I think that escalation dominance is obviously being taken seriously. Like, so from that standpoint, it's obvious to me that, like, the President Trump doesn't think like We can do whatever we want to these guys, and they're just going to take it. Like, he backed off his 48 hours because he knew what would happen, like, straight up.
So Chase, let's talk a little bit about the downstream effects of this. Like one of the questions that I wanted to get your take on is how much of the oil and gas in that region, let's say, Qatar being one of them, with the massive LNG exports, what was it, 20% of the world's LNG comes out of there, and how long is that offline for? Like, is it destroyed or is it temporarily offline until things get resolved?
So I think for Qatar LNG, you're looking at probably 2 to 6 months for any of it to be back. I think 6 months probably for it, like, any of it to be back. And that's 20% of the world's LNG. Now, 17% of their 20% of the world's LNG is what is offline for years, because they had 12 LNG trains at that facility. Two are, like, destroyed. So, I mean, that's substantial stuff. Now, we were definitely entering a period where we were about to have an LNG glut, like, too much of it. So we come in pretty well supplied. US keeps adding some supply. Theoretically, Australia can in the next couple of years, maybe, or something. But, like, it's a huge deal already that that happened. And same for oil. Like, you have over 10 million barrels a day of petroleum shut in. Like, forget not transiting. Like, the production has stopped. You have hundreds of millions of barrels that would have been produced that have not been produced. Like, and I think a lot of the just average people that don't get in the weeds on, like, energy, you think, oh yeah, but as soon as the war ends, like, they go and they turn the switch back on and the oil comes back. And
Exactly.
for some of these oil fields, it's almost that easy. But for a lot of them, there's pressure issues where you have to, some of these have very natural pressure, some of them do not. You have to introduce the pressure, which is a bigger physics problem than it sounds like. So it may take some time to reintroduce enough pressure to get it flowing. So there may be some stuff that comes back instantly. There may be some stuff that takes 6, 8 more months to come back online, from a production standpoint. So some of this is very real, and it's going to be, to me, like, for oil, you're a year to get back to normal. Obviously, for LNG, it's 6 months to get back to decent, and it three at least 3 years to get back to normal. And obviously there's a bunch of implications for that, and one of them is, the much maligned green sources like solar suddenly look, and not to mention much maligned source being coal. Those two are the opposite ends of the spectrum of people that decide to get too political about energy, and both become very attractive all of a sudden whenever you have less, oil and gas to deal with.
Well, that's exactly where I wanted to go, was does this mean a larger return to more coal usage for the world?
Yeah, I think for a year or two, you're gonna have way more coal use than we would have thought. But I think it also speeds up the transition for people. Like, I can't remember, is a country in Southeast Asia that was about to do a big LNG import terminal project. And they basically just went back to the government and said, you know what, forget that. We're going to do a giant solar plant instead. So, like, you're going to see a bunch of that. Like, if you look at a place like Pakistan, it used to be devastating for them whenever LNG got expensive. They've done so much solar in the last 5 years that now they're just kind of like, oh, well, that sucks. Like, whatever, we're fine. Obviously they're not fine, but, like, way less impactful for them. A lot of the countries that went kind of all out on the renewables that make sense for them, like, are suddenly in a way better position. People that didn't shut down their nuclear plants are in a way better position. Like, I mean, to me, like, all this stuff's pretty obvious. But and you look at the China, who has been on a feverish pace to depend less on imports of oil and gas. Like, I mean, they still very much depend on imports of oil and gas, but all those efforts and the fruit that it has borne is, like, it's showing itself incredibly right now. And something I don't think a lot of people know, like, dollar for dollar, China exports almost as much green technology as the US exports petroleum, and we are the biggest petroleum exporters on Earth. So, like, it I think a lot of people view them as like a big loser here, and it's like no, like the orders for their EVs and their solar panels and stuff is going to be through the roof.
How about other things, Chase? Like, obviously, fertilizer is another big piece of this puzzle that is going to contribute to higher food prices. Never mind fertilizer prices. There are crops that are obviously getting ready to be put in much of the northern hemisphere that are, I've heard that there is less than even a no bid situation, basically, for fertilizer. It's not even that you can't buy it for a higher price. You can't even, like, suppliers
Right.
aren't even listing it as available. So, what are some of those consequences as well of having the strait closed and having such a stress point in the Middle East there?
Yep. Also chemicals. So if you go and chemicals and fertilizers meet at a really ugly place, it's called the grocery store. Because if you go in the grocery store, almost everything you see in there was grown with fertilizer and is in plastic packaging.
Right.
So, and even if it's in paper packaging, sometimes there's a film on that paper packaging that has some sort of petrochemical background, right? So like, and a lot of times when you see nasty inflation at the grocery store, a lot of it's the packaging. It's not even the food sometimes because it's a big part of the cost. So if you think about it this way, the price of most food is going to go up because fertilizer is such a problem. Crop yields go down. Like it's just bad. And like you mentioned, some of it's no bid, and even if you have your fertilizer, but you run out of diesel, you're still in the same issue. And that we have seen that, and not just, I think a lot of people are viewing this like, well, I'm sure Bangladesh is having a hard time, but like we're fine here, in our modern country. But there's massive shortages in parts of Australia. The European Commission came out today and was like, hey. You should work from home, drive less, like run the AC less,
Yeah, wear a t-shirt inside the office
right.
up to
Yeah. And
the
that's Europe. Like that's Europe. That's not the Marshall Islands. Okay. Like this isn't going to discriminate. Places like the US will do better for longer. No doubt about that. Which may be bad because we feel so insulated that we're less likely to do something to stop the pain. But like it is a human catastrophe waiting to happen on the food side. Because the same thing, like rich countries will outbid you for petrochemical feedstocks, for oil products, for downstream fertilizer. Like, but if you get outbid by a rich country and you're a poor country, that's where you end up with it doesn't matter what the price is. Like, you aren't getting the diesel, you aren't getting the fertilizer, like you aren't getting the naphtha for your chemical plant. You just, sorry. And that's where like the worst outcomes kind of take shape, obviously. And that's where the resource nationalism like really pops up. And we've already seen it, like a lot of export bans from different countries for different things, both the downstream product side and the upstream like input side. And some of these countries kind of shoot first, ask questions later on that stuff. They're not going to wait around to see if there might be a shortage. They're just going to go, oh, we're not going to tolerate a shortage, so you can't have our stuff. And that creates its own, tensions in the world. So do starving people. Starving people create a lot of political instability and a lot of really ugly problems politically, if not conflict wise. So the dominoes have just begun to like fall. If the strait isn't opened, 2 months from now, we'll see, dominoes fall that a lot of people probably could not have imagined when the strait first closed. We all know we're globalized and interdependent, but I don't think people have a proper respect for the level that we are globalized and interdependent. I've been researching, speaking of me being a nerd, like the end of like the Iron Age, and the reality is one of the big reasons the Iron Age had such a big problem. Now a lot of it goes back to probably weather and drought and stuff, creating famine, but they're very interdependent. Like no one was self-sufficient even back then, when it was just kind of like eight powers like huddled around the Mediterranean and stuff, like they needed each other for stuff. So if they couldn't depend on each other for certain things, a lot of linkages broke in their own domestic supply chains. And like when you're really interdependent, there's a lot you can. It's a complex, very complex system. You can't model where it ends up. So the complexity of it can lead to places that you really can't see coming. So I think it requires a lot of humility and a lot of desire to get that thing open quickly.
It's funny, this idea, or this, let's say, this essay of iPencil keeps coming up over the last couple of weeks here, and really I think underscores the idea of interdependency and the complexity of our systems, right? That's something as simple as a pencil and takes basically the entire world to produce, never mind thousands upon thousands of tons of food and fertilizer and all of these things that go into making the modern world. And even though we enjoy a very high standard of living, let's say in North America, even as you said, a country like Bangladesh, to be able to support their food system, their energy system, the countries like that are really going to suffer. And let's say, the disparity between much of the world right now, how it's going to suffer versus North America, I think is that's a pretty crazy way to, let's say, absorb the consequences of a war like this that seems, again, so miscalculated.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing that no one, no leader thinks about, like, oh man, yeah, but what's gonna happen to the little sharecroppers and like that island in the Pacific that I've never heard of? Like, no one cares, unfortunately. But these are very real consequences, and sometimes they can expand years later. I just read this great essay yesterday about like basically all the dominoes that fell after the opium wars and like what it caused, and like and it's like very plausible, like that led to this, which led to this, which led to this, and you're just like, wow. All because like Britain just wanted some tea and porcelain from China, so they were like, and China's like, we don't want your stuff, and they're like, well, how about some opium? Like just that independent decision that had nothing to do with any of the stuff that came, and all the decisions in the opium wars, which on their own, from each individual's perspective, probably made perfect sense. Like, it's not some evil master plan. It's just like, oh man, we got to sell this stuff, and we really want some tea. Like, it can go to places that's very difficult to imagine. But I think that's why it's important to respect, complexity and respect complex systems, respect humanity. Like, you name it. Like, this stuff's important. And to your point, like, I want to super underscore anyone that hasn't read iPencil, like, stop what you're doing, pause this, go read iPencil. It's a very, very powerful essay to really wrap your head around. And it's if you think about it, it's just true. It's how it works. Like, about around the complexity in the most simple items in our lives, and then it's easy to imagine, the like a microchip. Like, well, it goes into that if there's people all over the world combining with strangers to build a pencil, and then if any like little linkage in that gets messed up, you have an issue for a little while. And but it also explains why like we're good at adapting and fixing problems quickly. So like, I don't want anyone listening to this to think like, oh man, we're all screwed. Like, maybe for the moment, but like we're really good at figuring stuff out, like, and making things better over time. So even if the strait was closed forever, we would have a nasty 5 years or whatever, but like we would engineer our way out of it. We would grow our way out of it. We would reorder our way out of it. We would innovate our way out of it. So all human problems are, they're temporary, but like that doesn't mean you disrespect the amplitude that they can carry in their moment.
Yeah, we'll put a link to iPencil again in the show notes there. Chase, where do you think US policymakers are at this point? Like, is the Fed scared to react yet? Like, we kind of started this conversation with the idea that markets don't really know what to price in, or they're not pricing in certain things. So because of that, is the Fed scared to react at this point, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're frozen. And I think that's proper for me personally. But as long as the strait is closed, or more than like 30% closed, I'll say, it doesn't matter. Like, to me, the Fed could cut to zero or raise to 10. Who cares? Like, it just doesn't. It's not going to change anything. Like you said, like some people are or are not going to get fertilizer, diesel, you name it, right?
It doesn't
Oil. If
the
oil's $200, like, 10% rates, they're not stopping inflation, not even close, right?
Interest rates can't get those molecules to where they need to be.
Right. This is such a physical problem, and I think modern man is very unaccustomed to knowing what that even means. Like I think it's why we've seen markets struggle with it. It's, it doesn't know how to price it because it's nobody's ever been through a physical constraint like this. So it doesn't make sense to people. And if it's kind of like you turn the hot water on, but it hasn't gotten hot yet, and everyone's like, oh, I think it's going to be okay, you guys. And it's like, no, like it just hasn't made it through the pipe yet. You should watch out. Like, I think that's a lot of it. And I hate to say it, but like, I think it's true that the rich world doesn't think things are real until they hit the rich world. I think we saw this with COVID. It's like, well, that sucks for China. Like, man, that's a bummer that they're getting that thing that only touches Chinese people, And then it was like, ooh, it's hitting Italians. They're a little bit more like us, but yeah, that's still Italy. It ain't here. And it's like, guys, like that's coming for you. Like that can travel, and it doesn't seem to actually care what you are other than human. So like, you're gonna get it. But the market didn't care until enough Americans got it. I think it's similar here. Like, oh, cool. Like, there's shortages in Thailand. Like, who cares?
Or
That's Thailand's
Australia.
problem. Yeah. But but when your neighbor is like, I'm not gonna be able to plant that corn this year. Like, or I am not going to work because I cannot afford the gas to get to work. Like, whenever it hits home in a more meaningful way, like that's when more people kind of sit up and take notice, I think. The average person doesn't even know what force majeure means. Like, so all the cluster of force majeures around the world on very, very important items, is something that's gonna be lost in people. Not to mention, like, and I think, I'm sure like a lot of your listeners will know this, but a lot of people don't. Like, that if you look on my screen right now, almost everything behind me has petrochemicals in it in one way or another. Like, oil is in almost every single thing in our lives. We only think about it as gasoline in our cars or diesel or whatever, but no, it's in everything. So like, the inflationary impact of that is so substantial because it touches everything. Not to mention, if the supplies get limited, it touches everybody. Not to mention, we keep seeing this like, oh, well, we don't need the Strait. Like, we're self-sufficient in energy. It's not true to begin with, but it's mostly true. But because we're so global, and hey, we actually do need, we all need fertilizer and petrochemicals, and we all need aluminum and these other metals. We all need helium. Like, we need a lot of stuff that comes out of the Strait. The Gulf is a significant percentage of the world's production of certain things, right? Like, you can't just lose that. So I think we have this view of like, it's like we're on a boat. I've seen this cartoon, like, you're on the front of the boat and you see guys bailing out water at the back of the boat. There's a big hole in it and it's about to sink, and you're like, man, I'm glad we're on this side of the boat. And it's like, no, the boat's going down. Like, that's a global economy. Like, it's just a boat with a hole in it on the other end of the planet, so nobody cares. But like, we're in that boat too. So like, we will also go down. And I think it's lost on regular people. Obviously, it's lost on Wall Street. I think it's lost on policymakers too. But as our part of the boat starts to take on some visible water, that's when policymakers panic. When policymakers panic, that's when you, as an investor, you unpanic. Like, you go the other way because they'll change reality by panicking.
To add to that, one of the other things that is very dependent on petrochemicals are pharmaceutical drugs. And right or wrong, it I don't I can't I let's say I haven't confirmed this story, but I read that Iran had attacked a one of the biggest generic drug supplying companies or manufacturers in the world, and that took that completely offline too. So, I mean, it doesn't just affect your ability to get to work, or if you have an electric car, you're going to be insulated. It's like it affects every single piece of our lives.
It really does. It's exactly right. Like helium, like, is a kind of thing. People are like, "What? I don't need a balloon." I'm like, yeah, well, you probably need an MRI. I bet you use microchips. Helium's a big part of making those. Like,
And
there's so many
it's
things that do so much in our lives, and we just it's invisible. It's like eye pencil. Like, you wouldn't know that the thing came from this place, and like yada yada yada. Like, it. There's so many things that we just take for granted because they're not visible, but they're there and they're real and they're tangible and they're physical. And if you interrupt them, like you don't get to avoid the, it's like the Ayn Rand quote, like, you may be able to like ignore the reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of reality.
Right. And again, if you take 30% of the supply of any one of these things offline, it's not necessarily solved by raising the rest of it by 30, like the price of the rest of it by 30%.
Yeah, and to your earlier point, like, sorry, but like monetary policy isn't going to do anything about it. Fiscal policy isn't going to do anything about it. I know those may make the stock market go up, but they're not going to change the realities of, not having enough blank or not having enough affordable blank. Like, so, if nothing else, like I do hope this opens a lot of people's eyes to like how important the physical world is. And you think about like SPRs and having strategic, backup of some of these things, like I think it gets more important. And but actually quickly, like to delve into that point, like you can have an SPR for oil, right? You can't have an SPR for helium and for LNG and for jet fuel. Like some of these things deteriorate being stored. Like, it's not like honey that has a shelf life of infinity, right? Like these things go bad quickly. Like these LNG ships that are stuck, they're literally like just leaking and escaping, and it's like less and less LNG as they sit there.
The same with the hydrogen, I believe. I was reading a story the other day that there's a bunch of hydrogen, or sorry, helium containers that are, or casks, I believe they call them, that are stuck right now. And without cooling, once that, I think they have 30 days or 35 days of ability to keep that temperature. And once that temperature starts to raise, all that helium just escapes and it's gone. There's, and not even like very few ports even have the ability to cool that and get it back to being stable. So, I mean, there's just so many downstream consequences to try and understand here.
If nothing else, like it should make us all appreciate the symphony of all of us as like little ants organizing our world that is so physical to like make everything as comfortable and cheap as it is. Like, it's easy to throw stones at globalism and globalization, but in reality, we've kind of created a pretty amazing miracle by going back to iPencil, like working with strangers all across the world at things we're good at to make it all, work so smoothly. Like, but if you put a stick in the spokes, you might flip over the handlebars,
That's a great way to put it.
though.
So Chase, kind of wrapping up here, what are the big, let's say the big plays that you're watching here for the next, I mean, I hate to say it, 2 weeks sounds like an eternity at this point, but is oil on your radar? Obviously coal is on your radar. Fertilizer, things like that. What about gold? Like what are some of the things that you are investing in, keeping an eye on, looking for our opportunities in?
Gold for me is kind of in the too hard pile for this because to me, gold is like a financial SPR that can be drawn down in a crisis like this. Because what's the point of having those reserves if you don't use them in a time like this to a degree? But at the same time, I mean, treasury holdings by foreign central banks are at 14-year lows, and that's not even inflation adjusted. So, like the scramble for gold is going to continue from central banks, and it may even accelerate. As the US is no longer as much of a security guarantor as we all thought. But that's medium term, stuff. But as far as like what I've been doing and what I think some asymmetric bets are now, one of them is sugar. I think sugar is really stands out to me because it has supply impulses, demand impulses, and it has a calendar effect because the planting is now. So they don't have enough, obviously, they don't have enough affordable fertilizer. That's an issue. A lot of the acres may get outcompeted for other kinds of plants that need less fertilizer. You can use it for sugar, or you can use it for ethanol, which is, fuel.
Right.
We have a giant shortage of that, so a lot of producers are going to like look at the price of sugar for, your M&Ms, and they're going to look at the price of sugar to put some fuel in your car and go, oh, we'll take that one. So then you further like they get that further, squeeze. Then you look at it and you have like a, there's a big refinery in the UAE. So they have a giant 2-year stockpile, I think it is, of raw sugar. But obviously they can't They can't get all their refined stuff out. They can't get new raw sugar in, so they may have to draw down their raw sugar stockpiles. Like, has its own impacts. So you have India going back to the resource nationalism. I think there's a decent chance India looks at this and goes, "Yeah, we're not going to export sh as much sugar as you thought, or maybe any, or something close to any." Massive, blows a huge hole in the supply and demand equation. So to me, that has a lot of independent drivers all huddled around the strait being closed that should, propel possibly sugar a good bit higher than where it is. Like, it has gone up after the strait closed, but I don't think anywhere near where it should be if the strait stays closed for another 3 weeks or something. And because they're planting it now, like, it doesn't matter if it opens in April, May, or whatever. Like, nope, sorry, like, game over. So, like, oil, you open in May, it has to react violently and come back down. But if you're sugar, you're like, nope, sorry, like, we that's that planting's behind us for the most part. So, like, I like that aspect of it. I don't have to be worried about, is it open, is it closed? Come May, I can be like, yeah, they didn't plant enough, and
Yeah,
what they
it's
did
like
plant didn't get enough fertilizer.
you missed your whole season on that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of other ag plays. Another big one to me, especially because we have El Nino coming, is cocoa. There's nothing worse than the combination of not enough fertilizer and an El Nino to just wreck cocoa. It's why we had that massive blow off in cocoa a few years ago, which thankfully, I don't say we saw coming. Like, we didn't know it was going to go that high, but we did see fertilizer shortage, El Nino. That was our thesis, right? Like, there you go, and it went nuts. You're staring down the barrel of the same exact thing about to happen, and cocoa's barely reacted. No one's talking about it, like, so that's another one that could pop off. Now, how bad the El Nino is and how it impacts the crops and their disease levels and all that stuff, like, who knows? But you at least have the preconditions for a move in cocoa that is not small. And yeah, I mean, like, to your point, like, oil, yes, absolutely. Especially for me, out on the curve a little bit. This December 27 oil is at last check about $68 a barrel. I don't think that's the right price if the war never happened. I don't think that's the right price if the strait was closed for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. So the strait can open tomorrow, and I'm still looking, and it'll go down from there. And I'm going to be looking at like $64 oil for the end of 2027. To me, that's the wrong price. Like, don't get me wrong, like, once we're open, like, the production will pick up, we'll make up for it, oil will go back down, we all get it. But, like, or to me, it's already worth at least that. If we get the Red Sea closed for 2 weeks in addition to the Hormuz or something, that kind of stuff is not even almost in that price of like December 26, 27, 28, whatever. Maybe I've gone too far out with 27, but that stuff I love. And one of the reasons it's down is because, some of the oil producers go out and hedge there. Maybe the airlines go out and hedge, whatever. Like, Mexico goes out and hedges production. But to me, like, that just means they're giving me a better price in a non-intelligent way. And I'm happy to be involved. I think equities, they've started to come off until today. We're 7% drawdown though. Like, that's not enough for this. So yeah, I'm not in there buying a bunch of equities. I've talked about the solar stuff. I think the whole electric stack, especially solar and EVs, is very much a place to look for the sell-off to get more intense. I think some of the things that are important, like rare earths, especially the kind of refinement, turning it into real magnets and stuff side, I want that stuff to get beaten down a little more so I can jump in. Same with like solar and EVs, and like, please beat it up so I can get more, because all this does is help some of those thematics. I came into the year with a big basket of chemicals and aluminum. I still love those. They're crushing it because the strait's closed. That's gonna make it awkward after the strait opens, though. I think I might book those, because it just pulled forward the cycle on such a crazy level that it may have actually ruined my whole thesis in the end. I don't know.
Right. Chase, I want to thank you for a really interesting and very, very wide-ranging conversation here. It was great to be able to nerd out with you here and really talk through a lot of these different things. Of course, for anybody that wants to hear more from Chase and read more of your work, that's all available at Pinecone Macro, pineconemacroresearch.substack.com, and of course, pineconemacro.com. Chase, real pleasure. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yep. Thanks, Tom. Always a wonderful pleasure. I appreciate you having me.